A close examination of the history of Australia's intelligence gathering offers an intriguing new perspective into international affairs and domestic politics in the first half of the 20th century. Sitting opposite me, former intelligence officer John Fay has done just that in the book Australia's First Spies, The Remarkable Story of Australia's Intelligence Operation, 1901 to 1945. And John, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. He is
heavily disguised, I should point out. What's the premise behind the book? More than professional interest?
Yes. Whilst professional interest plays its role, my main concern was with the image of Australian politicians and bureaucrats, leaders, in that period, 1901 to around 1945, which often portrays them as being prisoners of London or imperial servants. And
well,
I must say,
I'm quite shocked by your revelations. I took the view that that was a pretty accurate description, but you point out that Australia determined its own self-interest rather than being subservient to empire.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Australia's got a very strong history of self-interest. I mean, if we go back to the MacArthurs and from the MacArthurs downwards to people like Fisher and Deakin, Barton, these were men who were sacrificing a role as a big fish in a small pond for being smaller fish in a bigger pond. And that sacrifice has to have a payoff. Human nature would indicate that there has to be a payoff. And when you look at what was going on around Australia in the Pacific, as Australia lost its control of its environment to Germany and the Samoan Islands, to the Americans, to the Japanese, and Britain looked upon them as useless islands at the end of the earth of no intrinsic interest to Britain.
Did your experience as a former intelligence officer help in the research of this book? Did you see the material through a different prism?
Yes. I suppose in some ways it's a bit like you can look at a document in a couple of different ways, and there's the reading of the document which tells you A plus B equals C. But sometimes A plus B doesn't equal C. It's the way A and B are positioned on the page. So when you looked at some documentation, you could interpret it as just a bland document, but it's not. Once you read into it or you see how the document's constructed, or in fact, which file it's buried in, it's interesting that you're not allowed to hide things.
Well, but the interesting thing is you can. I chaired a few government agencies in the not-too-distant past, and when freedom of information came over the horizon, we pretty quickly learnt that you could, conceal.
There's a difference between concealing and hiding or making it difficult. Making it difficult is acceptable. Hiding or concealing or destroying, definitely destroying, is actually illegal, but making it difficult for people to find the appropriate file, and a lot of the time all you need to do is make sure that the title of the file is a little bit off key.
And also you can go elsewhere for information.
Absolutely,
can't you?
Yeah.
You can look through other records like financial records.
Yes.
Or admin records.
If there's one thing bureaucrats do very well, it's manage the money, account for every cent and where it goes and who uses it. And so whenever you look at an intelligence operation, the very first thing you want to know is what's its budget.
But surely a lot of intelligence budgets around the world are hidden.
They're hidden, but they're still declared, but they're not declared openly. You have to know where to look for them.
How do you approach this history with the assumption that nothing is what it seems and everything is more complex?
Actually, you approach it by looking at the files. And when I first started this, when we first put the proposal, an English friend of mine actually said it'll be the smallest book in history. And that was a concern for a little while. But as you went through the files actually tell their own story. And what you have to do is be faithful to what the story is and bring it out.
There's a lovely quote of Machiavelli that introduces the book. Never let any government imagine that it can choose perfectly safe courses. Rather, let it expect to have to take very doubtful ones, because it is found in ordinary affairs that one never seeks to avoid one trouble without running into another.
Yeah. It's a... One place you can't look for perfection is in politics, and you can't seek it in international affairs. And government, anybody who goes into government with the idea they can impose order on a chaotic or an anarchic system like we have internationally, very quickly finds out that you can't. What Machiavelli said is absolutely true today as it was in his day.
Let's look at the early years, 1901 to World War One, at the time of Federation. Why did Australia feel the need to develop its own intelligence capability rather than relying on the bombs?
Well, it's very simple, because you needed to double-check what London was telling you. So if you didn't have your own people on the ground, you didn't know whether the information you were getting from London was partial or spun or was untrue. And indeed, the Australian governments had started, particularly New South Wales as a colony, had started looking at relationships with Japan very closely. And indeed, New South Wales government policy at the time was that they saw a very close trading relationship with the Japanese. And whilst William Le Courtier, who went to the New Hebrides as a spy for Australia, worked fairly effectively there, we also had John Bly Sutter in Kobe, who was passing intelligence information back, including economic, political, and during World War One, military intelligence.
You make the point that at the time it was customary to choose your spooks, your spies, from the upper echelons of society.
Well, in the early stages, somebody had to have entree, and you couldn't get entree if you weren't a gentleman, and consequently the gentleman spy was born, and that's true. But at the same time, when you look at the history of, say, the Wernette Pearling Company, the people, Reg Hockings was not what people would call an upper class spy.
This is the Perler.
This is the Perler, working out of Thursday Island. And the Wernette Trading Company, or Pearling Company, is a very interesting organisation in that it was one of the very, very first commercial pearling organisations to be permitted to have AWA wirelesses. And what people forget about the AWA wireless was it was a government company. And so his pearling luggers were able to communicate with Thursday Island.
But in a sense, he was the rule-proving exception in terms of gentlemen.
One would say probably not, because most of the effective spying was done by the ordinary people who were filling jobs in naval vessels, on naval bases. If you go down the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria, you'll find the little plaques on the ground denoting where Royal Australian Naval wireless intercept units operated.
Is
along
that
the,
right?
The, yeah, they've
now,
marked
you
it.
Point out that Edmund Barton wanted to have a good, energetic and independent spook system. What about Billy Hughes?
Billy Hughes didn't like anybody knowing more than Billy Hughes, and Billy Hughes liked to constrain information so he could utilise it in the interests of Billy Hughes. One of the interesting things about Hughes is he's been dealt with very nicely by a lot of Australian politicians who seem to have overlooked the utterly destructive nature of the Hughes administration in 16 and 17. And his rather negative impact on Australian politics between 1919 and 1945, where he even managed to be around when Menzies got rolled.
He was the most problematic person, wasn't he?
A very difficult and awkward man, yes.
They should do a mini-series on Billy.
He would be an absolutely intriguing figure, because in some ways he inspired, but in other ways he was absolutely negative in his impacts.
So, at the time of Federation, the countries that we felt the need to spy on were the Japanese, for some of the reasons you've already described, and also the Germans and New Guinea?
Yeah, the Germans and New Guinea were fairly easy because they were concentrated in their settlements, their farms, their missions, and it didn't take long to roll up the German power base in New Guinea. It was done within a couple of months of the outbreak of war.
What about the French in the Pacific?
The French were more problematic for Australia in that Britain needed France's support to hold Germany to the line in Europe. Therefore, any French negotiations in the New Hebrides or around the New Hebrides, one of Australia's concerns was that the French would get far too much out of the British in return for their support in Europe. So French was more problematic for Australia.
Let's go back to the Japanese, because many listeners will be unfamiliar with the awesome fact that in 1904, they destroyed the Russian naval fleet.
Yes, the Battle of Tsushima Strait is the most significant battle since Trafalgar. In fact, it's really interesting. They're nearly 100 years apart. And the destruction of the Russian fleet was complete. I mean, I think only 5 warships escaped. And the Russians were completely destroyed. And it was a massive
blow. And that would have astonished the world, wouldn't it?
Oh, it...
Including the bigots.
Yeah, it did more than astonish. People talk about shock and awe. Shock and awe would describe what the Japanese did. And they did it with minuscule losses themselves.
Now, come closer, because I want to ask you something confidential here. I understand there were successful operations involving German code books at the very start of World War One, in, of all places, Melbourne's Port Melbourne.
Well, Melbourne and, more importantly, Fremantle. The Admiralty in London, and one of the things people tend to overlook is that the Admiralty ran a worldwide intelligence system. They could tell when a ship had left port or entered port within 24 hours.
Really?
Yes.
Without Google?
Without Google. One of the things they understood was on the declaration of war in Europe, the likelihood would be that ships' captains in German vessels in Australian waters would not get the message and would not destroy their code books. And that turned out to be absolutely and utterly true. The seizure of the Hobart as she came through Port Phillip Heads is the most famous of the stories. But the Griswold and the other ships seized in West Australia meant the capture of not just the merchant codes, but also the German naval codes.
So much to cover, so little time. Mm. Let's go to World War II.
Yes.
Did the Japanese have a developed spy network in Australia?
No. The problem in Japan was that being an intelligence officer, whether military or otherwise, made you a second-class citizen. And so consequently, the operational officers would collect their own intelligence. And so we would have Japanese officers coming through Australia collecting intelligence, but they weren't trained intelligence officers, so they made a hash of it. So their foreign intelligence collection was abysmal.
What about Australian Nazis in Germany?
No. The problem with the Nazis were they're easily identified, a little bit like if you look at today's environment, it's very easy to identify people who are affiliated with different extremist viewpoints. And the Germans and the Italians were more sophisticated, but also easily identified.
Okay. There was a very high mortality rate for Australian human assets, to use the jargon, in places like Timor, Java, Sumatra and Japan.
Japan itself was a hard nut to crack. One of the things that people don't realise about the Japanese intelligence system was, whilst it was bad at foreign intelligence, it was utterly effective as a security intelligence organisation. You could not operate where the Kempeitai were. And that's the Japanese gendarmerie or the military police. So where the Kempeitai were established, all human operations ceased almost immediately. And the reason was they used very sophisticated techniques, including the double-cross system, as well as extreme brutality.
Okay, let's go back to the fact that there was 100 or 95% mortality rate in many of these areas.
Well, in Timor itself, the Services Reconnaissance Department, which is the army controlled special spying, special forces organization, punched in group after group after group. What they didn't realize is that the radio messages they were getting back from Timor, from the earlier groups, were controlled by the Kempeitai. So whilst Britain was running an effective double-cross system against the Germans, the Japanese were running a very effective double-cross system against the Australians. The 5% survivors were those people who were cooperating with the Japanese.
Dare I ask about Russians? Because as a teenage communist, I was quite enthusiastic about them.
The infiltration of Australian government agencies and departments between 1942 and 1945 was significant. The case, which a lot of people discuss, arose out of the fact that ultra intelligence was detected being sent by the Japanese from Harbin in China to Tokyo. And they hadn't changed the content of the messages down to the numbers. So the Australians were reading their own ultra information coming back at them.
So the derision that we in fact heap upon ASIO, certainly people like me do, having had ASIO files, is really misplaced, isn't it, in terms of the quality of our intelligence gathering during these years?
Well, it's difficult to speak of ASIO in those years because ASIO did not exist till 1949. But ASIO was created as a result of the case. And the real concern was the protection of ultra, of signals intelligence. Now, the story that you get with ASIO belongs to the security service of World War II. And the crimes committed by that organisation are quite significant.
We've got to wind up, John, but it's a terrific book. It really is, and I can't wait for the television show. John Fay, his book, Australia's First Spies, the remarkable story, and it turns out to be very remarkable, of Australia's intelligence operations, 1901 to 45. It's published by Allen and Unwin. And if you're in Sydney, John will be talking about First Spies at the State Library of New South Wales, Thursday the 7th of February at 12:30.